There's 100 million farm workers. Most of them are in poverty. In Costa Rica, you can be in a union, but not if you're a foreigner. Which means
all the workers are going to be foreigners.
Exactly. Because there's so many people that work in coffee and they earn so little, it actually makes coffee like a major development problem. In a sense, if we could fix coffee, we could fix a lot of global development issues.
And I thought it was.
No, I really thought it was. It's really illegal.
Like, okay, this is looking like United States.
It is literally illegal.
Yeah, turning a blind eye and choosing to turn a blind eye on all of this, which means that you're choosing the laws that you want to enforce. And you probably only enforce them when somebody violates it who is a political enemy to you.
An all new episode.
No politics.
No one is talking about this.
No politics.
So Itel Igonet, the director of Coffee Watch, a nonprofit watch group that ensures that industry workers and farmers across the globe are treated fairly and without being enslaved or exploited. So, Itel, walk me through kind of what's going on.
Yeah. You know, most people have no idea what lurks in their cup of coffee. And of course, it's a delightful, delicious, important way to start your day. I cannot start my day without coffee. But
I was going to ask if you want Starbucks or something before, because down here, but I'm like,
My husband is the best. He makes me a little cup of oat milk latte every morning. Otherwise, I'm like a drunk, discombobulated hedgehog. He's my coffee angel. But, you know, coffee isn't just delicious and a great way to start your day. If you regularly drink coffee, you probably are drinking child labor and modern slavery. And also nature destruction. It's not just deforestation. I mean, coffee is the number six driver of deforestation in the world, which is really bad. I know, that's very bad. But also the effluents are almost never treated. So they go straight into rivers and they kill and acidify rivers. And a lot of coffee is grown in pesticide soaked monocultures. And not the regenerative, beautiful shade-grown systems that, you know, are like a shining beacon of hope for birds and bats and butterflies and small taxa like that, you know, that thrive in shade-grown coffee. A lot of coffee is not grown that way. It's grown in basically monocultures that are poisoned, where it's just like death for birds and bats and insects.
And what would be the point of using those chemicals? Does it like help expedite the farming process?
Look, you know, there are terrible pests that do attack coffee.
Yeah.
And so there are organic ways of fighting against coffee pests, just like there are chemical ways of fighting against coffee pests. But I think the real answer to your question is that humanity has become kind of addicted to pesticides. And we see that they are overused, that they're used by people who don't even really know how to read and write very well. So they don't know how to read the label. They put many times too much. They don't even know how to protect themselves. So they do it without gloves, masks, you know, without any of the proper PPE. We see that.
Oh, so it's basically like the workers are being exposed to all this.
Kind of like minors in, you know.
Oh my God. Even children are exposed to agrochemicals in coffee. It's really bad for their development. This is why when you have kids plus chemicals like paraquat and glyphosate and stuff like that, it equals hazardous child labor according to the ILO.
Oh, wow.
So it kind of bumps the child labor up when kids are exposed to chemicals or really heavy loads, or sharp objects like machetes. There's a lot of these problems in coffee, and it doesn't have to be that way. Coffee can be as good as it tastes. It can like save the world with every cup. We could choose differently if we cared.
Yeah. Well, and where are we talking like location-wise? Where are the countries doing this type of practice? And like also, what are kind of like the demographic of, I know you mentioned children, but of the workers too. And then also obviously like the farmers and the people that are in that supply.
It's interesting because I see this map right behind you. Yeah. And I mean, Brazil's the number one coffee producer in the world. They're like the titan of coffee. Mm-hmm. Probably about a third of global coffee comes from Brazil. Vietnam is number two. Nobody really knows that in general.
Vietnam number two. I thought it'd be like Colombia.
No, number two. No. Vietnam is number two. Colombia is number three. So you're close. Okay. You're close. Good job. And Indonesia is number four. And those countries together make up more than like two thirds of global coffee, depending on the year. So they're kind of the behemoths, I guess you could say, like the coffee giants. And then after that, coffee grows all over the tropics. So although a lot of other countries don't make enough volume to be considered really important for the global coffee trade, coffee can be super important for their GDP and their workforce. Like, coffee is actually very important for Mexico and for Costa Rica and Rwanda. Yeah, it's an economic issue. And so you're spot on to ask about the workforce. There are about 25 million coffee farmers and about 100 million farm workers. Most of them are living in poverty.
100 million farm workers.
It's a lot of souls on planet Earth that are in coffee. We think that there's about 12.5 million farms and about 25 million farmers. But especially around harvest season, you have to have pickers come in. And spraying season, you need sprayers. And actually, even year-round, people tend to need farm workers, although less than at the harvest season. That's why there's 100 million farm workers. That's a lot. Lot of people, and almost none of them earn a living income. Most of them are in poverty.
Well, it's seasonal work too, right?
It's for the farm workers, it can be 3 months or 6 months a year. And for the coffee farmers, it's like all year round, there's different things you have to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, because there's so many people that work in coffee and they earn so little, it actually makes coffee like a major development problem. In a sense, if we could fix coffee, we could fix a lot of global development issues. You can see a glass half full or a glass half empty, you know? If we could get our hands wrapped around the problem of how do we get a living income to all the workers and the farmers, then we would solve so many development problems, which is kind of a beautiful way of thinking about it, although it's also, you could think about it in a more depressing way, which is that coffee drives poverty.
Yeah. I mean, and people are willing to pay because, I mean, a matcha latte right downstairs, I mean, goes for like $8 right downstairs from the studio here. And but so like basically Brazil, to walk through like the process then. So Brazil, 60% of the mix, they make 60% of the coffee. About
31 to 39%.
Oh, of the total world's. Okay.
Of the total world supply. But you were just saying something that really caught my attention. So you talked about how much people pay for a latte here in the U.S. Did you know that if you were going to get a regular latte in a regular chain in a regular place in the U.S., 0.4% of that money goes to the coffee farmers? 0.4%. That's why they're so poor.
We're not
allocating the money to them, right? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's, I mean, where's the money going then?
It goes to the aggregators who collect the coffee a little bit, and a little bit to the exporters and importers that trade the coffee, like literally in giant cargo ships. But a lot of
the wholesalers?
A lot of it goes to the retailers and the roasters and the cafe chains and the restaurant chains. And actually the supermarkets take a big cut too. So it's really on the tail end of the supply chain that the profits go up. And at the front end, where it's the backbreaking labor, that's where people get very little, which is maybe the opposite of how it should be.
Yeah, the opposite of what you would think.
Yeah.
But there's got to be obviously some manipulation because of companies' market hold on some of these farms. Because, I mean, you would think obviously somewhere along the line that farmers would get together and start their own little institution to try to battle against the people above them that are taking their product and marketing it up. I'm sure the farmers in like Brazil don't have the power to maybe cut companies out. But I got to think, I mean, like, for example, a small farm in Brazil, what's stopping them from selling directly to, say, you know, Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks?
This is such a good question. I'm so glad you asked. Because when you talk about it, it really, I think, opens up people's minds to what does it mean to be a farmer? And how do you like demand better conditions and a better price and stuff? So in Vietnam, which is the number two coffee producing country, it's, I think it's fair to say, a ruthless dictatorship. I mean, that's kind of how I would describe politically the situation in Vietnam. So it is totally illegal to have a farmers union and to organize farmers to demand better conditions. So that's the number two coffee producer of Vietnam. But China, I think, is number 13. Correct me if I'm wrong. And also totally illegal to advocate as a farmer. And
yeah, like, I mean, two communist countries.
Yeah, if you and I were in China, like, and we decided to band together for better prices, we would probably end up in jail, I think. But actually, you know, Colombia, which you had correctly surmised, is one of the biggest coffee producing countries, the number three global producer. Literally, it is the most dangerous place in the world to be a union organizer or a farm worker.
In Colombia?
Colombia. You die. Like, you get killed.
Really? Petrol's got a hold on Colombia then, huh?
It's also, you know, in a way, there's parts of Colombia that are a narco state. It's not a country that has a super fantastic reputation for rule of law, but it's crazy in Brazil too. Most people probably don't know this who are watching your show, but if you and I were brasileiros making coffee in Minas Gerais or whatever in Brazil, because Minas is sort of the beating heart of Brazilian coffee, like half of Brazilian coffee comes from there. It is also one of the most dangerous places in the world to get together and advocate. Brazil has like the highest rates of killings for environmental activists. It's very dangerous to be a labor organizer or a human rights activist in Brazil as well. And under Temer and Bolsonaro, the coffee unions got kind of squished and they still haven't really bounced back. So you're totally right that farmers can get together and advocate for better conditions. And I would say whenever it is safe to do so, you see that they try.
They are
like, this is not cool. I'm not cool with this. Change. I want change. But what happens is that over and over, you see that a lot of farmers are living in war zones like Ethiopia or narco states like Chiapas is one of the top producing regions for coffee in Mexico. And Chiapas is 40% controlled by the cartels, 40% by Zapatistas. So yeah, it's really hard to demand better conditions in some of the coffee producing.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously then you're thinking it's, the government has, because also, and I'm thinking about this now, you mentioned China, I mean, with their labor practices, I mean, Vietnam, Brazil, Colombia, I mean, a lot of them have that sort of, not trying to put my, like an opinion spin on this, but like in communist governments, typically what makes them communist is the government having control over kind of private markets. And that's the biggest label that, you know, once government gets into businesses and almost taking a cut out of things and making rules in order to enhance its own wealth, then I feel like you get kind of this where the businesses just, there's only so much that they can do unless they play ball. And even if they do, they're still not making what they probably should be making. Because I know that does Venezuela by chance do any coffee? They don't really do too much because they're a little bit more north than where it's able to be grown.
Coffee kind of has to grow in the coffee belt.
In that little, yeah.
But you know, the crazy thing about abuses in coffee is I first went in, when I started Coffee Watch, thinking, okay, we're going to find, you know, a couple countries that have problems and countries with solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And my jaw dropped when I realized that pretty much every single coffee growing country has child labor, bonded labor, whether it's India, Mexico, Indonesia, Colombia, Brazil, China. we see recurring reports everywhere. And this made me realize that although we have done investigations with wonderful sister NGOs like in China Coffee, in Mexico Coffee, in Colombian Coffee, in Brazilian Coffee, now in other geographies, we have teams in the field. It's really the industry that has a problem, like globally, rather than one origin. And that gave me pause because I was like, okay, what does that tell us? What does that mean? Does that mean we need a big industry change?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, do we need consumers around the world to wake up and smell the coffee and say, no, change my coffee, please. Yeah, I want ethical, sustainable coffee in the morning. I want to make the world better every day with my cup of Joe. I don't want to, you know, be responsible for abuses, like unwittingly, basically, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're still playing a role too in it, you know, when you drink that coffee. The what are the, like, I'm assuming the farmers are obviously, you know, citizens of that country, business owners of those countries. Now, who really are the laborers, the people on the farms that are pulling the coffee beans out? Are they just like the poorer citizens of each country? Or are they just migrant workers that are from other countries? I mean, where are these people coming from to work on these farms?
I love your questions so much. These are like my dream questions. Actually, it's really fascinating because a lot of the most abused coffee workers that are farm workers that are seasonal, like harvesters, pickers, and sprayers, they tend to be either totally migrant workers, like refugee migrant workers, or internal migrants. So for example, in Brazil, in these really big plantations, Brazil's almost the only coffee growing country that has many, many, many big plantations. Mostly it's small family farms around the world, but Brazil has one plantation allegedly makes more coffee than all of Bolivia. They're big, plantations. Yeah, they're like crazy big. So they tend to get migrant workers internally from the poorest regions of Brazil. And they bring them in from quilombos, which are often areas where back in the day, slaves would run away and free themselves and like fight against the slave state from these little pockets of resistance that have today become quilombos. I mean, of course, slavery is abolished in Brazil, but the guys from the quilombos will be recruited by gatos. They're called in Brazil, we would say maybe in the US, coyotes, right? These gatos will bring the guys in, acting pretty much as human traffickers, and trap the guys in debt bondage and modern slavery often.
Mm.
So if you were a really poor dude from the quilombos, I would go, I'd find you, I'd be like, oh, I have a fantastic job for you, opportunity, sign here. You'd be like, cool, okay, get on a bus, and I drop you in the middle of nowhere. You don't know anyone, you have no friends, you have no family, and I tell you, surprise, surprise, you owe me $200. You're like, what? I'm like, yeah, you signed here, and if you don't pay, you're gonna keep accumulating interest. And I'm going to trap you. And by the way, everything you need is from a very expensive little store that kind of belongs to either the plantation owner or someone close to them. And you don't have the ability to go anywhere else to buy your necessities. So you're just trapped and you might end up with less money than when you started. So this is like the internal migrant kind of problems that you see, particularly in Brazil. But actually, we saw in Colombia that they had Venezuelan, I guess I would call them refugees, or economic refugees who are doing some of the worst jobs in Colombian coffee. And we know also that in Mexico, some of the most abused migrant workers are Guatemalans. We know in Costa Rica, some of the most abused workers are also immigrants from like Nicaragua.
Mm.
So basically, if your country is in terrible shape, you might go to a slightly better place close by and work for a season, but you're so vulnerable that you like basically are at the bottom of the pecking order in that country. Like in Costa Rica, you can be in a union, but not if you're a foreigner, which means
all the workers are going to be foreigners.
Exactly. So if all your workers are foreigners, none of them can be in a union. They can't ask for better conditions. Yeah. So you got it.
Mm.
So there's a lot of migration in coffee.
Yeah. Cause you get the cheap labor, with little rights. I mean, I can't like sit on like a moral pedestal either and say in about these countries too, because the United States, you know, with the migration into the United States, it's all backed behind people trying to get cheap labor for mainly construction jobs.
Can I tell you a crazy thing about American migration and coffee? Yeah. A lot of people who come from Central America to the U.S. were coffee farmers.
Mm.
But their coffee collapsed when they got hit by pests and really bad droughts. And so they just went bust because they were already so poor. They had these razor thin margins, and then they migrated to America. So in a way, the migration problem in the US is often also a coffee problem. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, wow. That is.
I know. People from Mexico, from Guatemala, from Nicaragua, from Honduras, from Colombia.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I didn't realize that until I like read all these articles and studies and
Yeah. Well, also too, I mean, the thing is, if I'm an alien from space and I come to the world and I speak English, can understand language, you know, I look at laws and I would look at what people say about like worker exploitation, and I would say, well, that doesn't sound true because look at all these laws that I've researched. You know, the United States has a lot of laws about illegal immigrants working, you know, under the books. They have these minimum wage laws and these worker safety laws. And then South America, too. Like when you were speaking of the child labor being a problem, I'm doing research and I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, if I was an alien right now looking at this, I go, how can child labor be a problem when the youngest age as a child can work in Brazil is 16, Colombia it's 15, Indonesia 13, Ethiopia 15, Honduras 14, India 14, Uganda 12 years old, Peru 14 years old, Mexico 15 years old. And these are like the top nine outside of Vietnam. And it's like, if that's true, you know, these are teenagers, they're not children. So then I'm like, how could child labor be an issue then? And that it must be an obvious then choice to not enforce these current laws, because I'm looking at some of these countries where notoriously people think, you know, it's horrific to work there. And I'm looking and, you know, these notes that I have, Brazil has comprehensive employee protections where the standard work week is 44 hours and it's there's mandated salaries, overtime pay, and even robust social security contributions involved. In Colombia, there's a comprehensive Colombian labor laws, and they cover aspects like regulated working hours, which the working week there is being redacted to 42 total hours by 2026. There's mandatory paid benefits, vacation, maternity and paternity leave, mandatory social security.
Yeah.
And I at the same time, I can't practically think that migrant workers, seasonal workers are experiencing the ability to take paid vacation. So then it's obviously got to be a choice to not enforce these laws, which I think of Colombia as a really good example of this, because Petro, the president, I walked into this conversation literally a month and a half ago. I was speaking to a gentleman who knows Petro personally, allegedly. He was telling me about some of their initiatives. And I was asking him, I was like, you know, just food for thought, people that I know in America, it's a big thing where you go down and to Colombia and you have sex with like a bunch of like prostitutes there. And you spend a weekend down there and they have this sex trafficking, like real sex trafficking issue down there. And I know of a lot of people that have gone down to Colombia for a weekend and have utilized some of these, what I would call services that I've thought were legal because they're so in the open. And people talk about it as openly as we would a vacation to, you know, Vegas or California. And so I thought it was legal this whole time. So I'm talking to this gentleman who knows the president personally, allegedly. And I'm like, you know, is it illegal there to do this, these like participate in this sex trafficking stuff, like a tourist going down there? And he got like offended and he was like, no, it's not legal. It's highly illegal. You face big fines and you can go to jail. A lot of people who come down to do it never get back on the plane to go home and blah, 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 blah. And I'm believing them. But then I'm thinking about like the people that I know that have gone down there and come back and it's fine. And I'm thinking, well, so you have all of these laws in place. And the guy said that this is Petro's like number one issue he's trying to tackle, which to me just like goes in one ear and out the other, because clearly I have evidence of people of doing this, but yet, and it is against the law, but it's being so in the open because tourists only go into like Medellin and Bogota, like the prize places they stay, that is clearly in the open, and yet all this is going on and no one's doing anything about it. So when I do these researches and I find this, you know, the child labor laws, and I look at all this and I'm like, there just must be a blunt, intentional,
turning a blind eye.
Yeah. Turning a blind eye and choosing to turn a blind eye on all of this, which means that you're choosing the laws that you want to enforce, and you probably only enforce them when somebody violates it, who is a political enemy to you, you know, which is, just the same. And then I think like, okay, what can be done then for these poor child workers if it's already against the law? Because in America, a lot of times people spend years and years and a lot of money trying to lobby to get things passed to become law. But then if there's no enforcement of the law, then there's really no law in the first place. So like from your point of view, knowing that a lot of this is already against the law, I mean, really, what are your thoughts of like being able to tackle this issue to really stop it? Is it a consumer thing where we need to like go down there, record children slaving in these farms and jam it down the throats of Americans to be like, this is where your coffee bean is coming from? You know, you need to make a change. I mean, what do you think?
So you are absolutely right that child labor and forced labor, bonded labor are not legal like anywhere.
And I thought it was.
I really thought it was
up until this.
It's really illegal.
Like, okay, this is looking like United States.
It is literally illegal in most places in the world to have children do the kind of work that they routinely do in coffee. And I think we could say people are just turning a blind eye. We could say some of the producer governments are not necessarily failed states, but troubled states, and lack the wherewithal to do meaningful, good law enforcement. But we could also say that the lack of consumer pressure means the industry is also turning a blind eye. So you have the government turning a blind eye, industry turning a blind eye. The net result is two blind eyes, and consumers don't know, and they don't put pressure, and therefore nobody really does that much. So I'll give you just a couple examples of what I mean. You know, the Brazilian government literally does go and free people who are in modern slavery in these coffee plantations.
Oh, they do.
They do. And so much so that there have been more than 3,700 slaves freed in coffee in the last couple of years. And we think that coffee made up like 11% of the slave freeing raids that the fiscalização, the Brazilian labor inspectors, were doing. But the Brazilian inspectors have only inspected about 0.1% of Brazilian coffee farms.
Oh, holy shit.
So
that's massive.
We could do the math. 3,700 people have been freed from essentially modern slavery in Brazilian coffee farms. It's one of the top drivers of slavery in Brazil. if not maybe the top, hard to tell. But we've only visited 0.1%. So if we visited 1% or 10% of the farms,
yeah, if you do the math,
would we find 300,000 slaves? 3,030? You know, we will never know because this is in the realm of the hypothetical. But clearly what this says to us is that the governments in producer countries are trying to do something, but it is grossly inadequate to deal with the magnitude of the problem. And so that's like, Brazil's not a failed state. It's a very successful country in many ways. And it's not a really poor country. But let's talk about a very poor country that's sort of connected iconically with coffee, because Ethiopia is actually the birthplace of coffee, right? Okay, so Ethiopia just had a civil war with the Tigray, where it's estimated that 600,000 people died. That's a lot of people. It's kind of a tentative, tenuous peace right now between Ethiopia and the Tigray region, but there's also unrest with the Oromo. Basically, I would say there's maybe like three semi-quasi-civil war type situations in Ethiopia right now. And it's one of the least functional, poorest countries in its region. And so law enforcement around child labor there is de minimis. And the best study we know of that was done by these university chaps that are like some of them of Ethiopian origin, but they're all in these Scandinavian universities. They went and studied child labor in Ethiopian coffee. They found that 91% of coffee farming families were using child labor.
Oh, shit.
Jeez. That means you have to be turning two blind eyes completely. And so exactly what you said, this is like on purpose that you are turning a blind eye. Do you not think it's a problem? Do you not have the money to hire people to go fix this? But I think fundamentally the reason we have all this child labor is because the price of coffee is so low that the parents are kind of close to starving. A lot of farmers are in food insecure situations. So they sort of have no choice. If you were my son and I was a coffee farmer in Ethiopia, it might be like, well, Daniel, either you go to school and we kind of starve, or I pull you out for 3 months. So you're going to be at the bottom of your class and you might drop out after a couple of years of that because you just can't keep up. But at least we're not going to go hungry. Maybe you're the one that takes the hit for the family and one of your siblings gets to stay in school, you know? But yeah, a lot of parents don't feel they have the choice because they're so poor. So in a way, the industry is kind of creating the conditions for the crimes to happen at scale by paying so little for the coffee farmers and farm workers. And then these under-resourced governments don't have the wherewithal or don't care enough to crack down on the like massive problems that flow from that.
Well, it reminds me of, the original settlers in America. I should say like the Europeans coming to America and starting to settle and starting to create, you know, start their own kind of cultures and whatnot, but also bringing some of European culture too. You know, when they started harvesting, the reason that we have summers between school, you know, last day of school and then between the first day of school, that was because we needed the children to help on the farms. And they were able to come up with that good system, which was everybody's off between the harvesting season. So it's all hands on deck because we need all hands on deck. It doesn't sound like there's that... you know, they don't have that hand on their own people in a way that they can make all that happen. Because if they did work together like that and had the whole system to come together, where come harvesting season for coffee, you know, all hands on deck, and then once that's over, then we shift to whatever we choose to shift to. I mean, that could be a start. But I mean, is that ever? Do you ever see any type of progress with that in Ethiopia?
So Ethiopia is not the only coffee-producing country. We found a report that said that 74% of Colombian coffee farming families use kids, 64%, we think, in Honduras. I could go on and on. But like, I think there's so many different kinds of solutions to child labor in coffee. It's never going to be a silver bullet. It's going to be silver buckshot. So, you know, one solution would be a living income price. There actually was a stabilized price of coffee thanks to the International Coffee Agreement for like well over a decade. And the middle class in Vietnam and Colombia was partly built off of that. And then that system collapsed. And then since then, the price has been really volatile and often very low. But so we could go back and have a kind of a stabilized global price of coffee where you have a floor under which the price cannot fall, but then above that, it can fluctuate according to the market trading. So that's one part of it. I think another part of it is to reorient schools so that, as you said, the calendar is adapted for teenagers to be able to work with their families when it's not like child labor, but, you know, normal teenage labor, like summers, like you said, you know, there are laws in all these countries. Is it 15, 16, you know, and on the summer, like, of course you can't do hazardous child labor. You shouldn't have heavy, heavy loads and pesticides and you shouldn't have sharp objects. But how do we reorganize everything so that we can shrink the problem of child labor and coffee and make it that if I was talking to you 5 years from now, it would be a minor problem and not the norm. You know, I think there's all these different things we can roll out if we care. Child monitoring remediation systems for child labor. They're called CLMRS. The industry uses them a lot in cocoa. There's so many different ways to
You know? But as you're talking, I'm already going in my head, oh man, we would be years away from this happening. Because the first step, you know, having the kind of a price standard makes complete sense. In reality speaking, though, my mind goes, I mean, you would say the United States, Brazil being the number one producer right now in coffee, United States being the number one consumer in coffee, right? And to have a price-based solution, you would need those two countries to really work together. And you know where I'm going with this. And
now's not a great time for that.
Because if you guys don't follow, Trump and President Silva right now are kind of like
at loggerheads.
Obama and Trump in the same room. You know what I'm saying? I mean, Silva just said that he has zero relationship with Trump, and it
it's true.
And to give background too, this is actually a great point, because this goes to show people just that it's not, you know, just finding the right puzzle pieces together, and it's making them fit, because it would be great to have a price solution, but in order to do that, you need cooperation. And Brazil in the last couple years has, I would say, it's actually fascinating, because their political climate in the last couple of years is almost like the same as to how the United States has been. And in the United States, you guys obviously know, but in Brazil, Silva is president who just in the early 2020s, Bolsonaro was the previous president, conservative president, who after Silva gets elected, Silva's I don't want to say administration investigated, but right now Bolsonaro was just sentenced to 27 years in prison.
That's right.
So there's a lot of political
tension
between conservatives and the right wing and the left wing there, which is like looking in the mirror here in the United States. And
they were like, "Oh, hold my caipirinha. You want to do that? We can do it too."
Exactly. So Trump sticks his head in and goes, "You know, we're going to throw a 50% tariff on you guys because you have a 10% tariff on us already. So we're going to add 40% to take what we're going to put 10% and then add another 40% on, because we don't like that. We also don't like that you guys banned Twitter." Because Brazil wanted Elon Musk to ban certain accounts during political season. So they, Brazil and Elon Musk refused. They wanted Elon to put a Brazilian lawyer to face court. Elon refused. So they banned Twitter. President Trump sticks his hand in and says, all right, here's the massive tariff. And now you have basically what is the example of every single, what can is the example of what happens in when political climates get like this, which is the same case in every other country in the world, which is the lowest income earners typically feel the consequences most because of those decisions and that lack of ability to be able to work together to solve a problem. Because, you know, I just with those parameters right now, I think we might be the furthest away from the United States and Brazil being able to kind of work on this too, because it's not a good time. It affects, I mean, Brazil's the beef industry, which is huge in Brazil. Cacao and seafood.
And, oranges.
Yeah.
But coffee's kind of Brazil's.
And Brazil's thing.
Brazil's thing. It's like the iconic crop that the whole nation is sort of associated with. Their soul is like cafe, caipirinhas, and mm-hmm. futebol, you know?
Yeah.
I would say, though,
and
that...
And the churrasco.
Churrasco. Oh, my husband loves... He's Brazilian. He does lots of churrasco. He's really good at it. But I will say, I'm an endless optimist. My father says I embody the triumph of optimism over experience. But I like to think that I'm just a glass half full person, or since we're doing coffee, maybe mug half full person. I think, you know, these are troubled times, but I believe reason will prevail. I think these tariff wars will come to an end. And when the time is right, it would be great to be able to revert to something like an agreement. It wouldn't necessarily have to include even the consumer countries. It could just be the top 10 producer countries. Think about petroleum, right? Where OPEC, it's not like all the oil consuming countries said, yay, OPEC. Yeah. The producer countries just got together and said, this is it. This is the price of oil. So for they coffee, could. It could be the same.
And a lot of those coffee producing countries have the same policies as each other. You know, with Vietnam, I mean, being in that more, I would say, government involvement with businesses, they do seem kind of similar to each other. So
look, you know, it's not easy, as you pointed out, to organize a global price for coffee that would guarantee like a living income price that would protect all the people that you were talking about who are really getting the fuzzy end of the lollipop. They're just like the lowest income folks, right? But good things are never easy, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try and do them. I'm such a believer in try again. And I think actually, you know, for a lot of coffee producing countries, this is almost existential. There are basically no coffee farmers earning a living income right now in the world. And a living income is exactly what it sounds like. Yeah. It's like literally what you can live on. It's not a dignity income or a wealth income. It means your basic food, your basic medical care, basic clothes. It doesn't even like, if you get cancer, no.
Without any rainy day.
Yeah, without any sort of big bad things factored in. This is just to live on. So most coffee farmers are actually living in what the World Bank calls poverty. There's this line that the World Bank has developed with all these economists. It's like $3 a day. Most coffee farmers tend to be under that on a bad year. So if there's droughts, if there's super storms, if there's like
shorter season,
if there's whatever reason you have a bad harvest, or if the global price goes really low, because we were talking about how it fluctuates, right, and can go so low. This year it's been really high, but a lot of years it's so low that many coffee farmers fall under the World Bank line of extreme poverty, which is $2.15. And $2.15, that is very hard to live on. If you or I had to live on $2.15 a day, I mean, you know, we would really feel it. Just like for your listeners to think about that, what would that be like? It's horrible, actually. So maybe coffee producing countries will band together. We just have to help them do it, you know? We have to give lots of support and ideas and have economists lean in and specialists and experts help and consumer pressure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely the optimist side. I mean, the more issues I talk on things, the more I just, you know, there's not, I used to ask people the question, if you had, you know, is this an issue that we can solve with unlimited money overnight? And this really doesn't seem like that, because there's a lot of factors that I feel like are involved that have nothing to do with coffee.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
I don't know. It's tough. It really is.
But I have good news for something that's like more of an overnight solution, because you just said overnight and it popped in my mind. This would not solve all of global coffee. So just to be clear, you said all, and I was like, oh, this is only half. But Daniel, half of global coffee is certified. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, wow.
That's kind of amazing, right? And that's really high compared to other agri-commodities. Like cocoa is less than 30%. Palm oil is like 26% probably that's certified with like a reputable certification. And when you look at soy, it's way, way lower. So most of the high-risk commodities that drive global deforestation, you know, which is like cattle, soy, palm oil, pulp and paper, cocoa, coffee, rubber. And also, I should say, not only drive global deforestation, but labor abuse too. Those are like, they're sort of the big bad wolves, the seven deadly sins of deforestation. Yeah. Most of them are not so highly certified. Coffee is exceptional in that regard.
Oh, really?
And not a single certification has a living income price. Oh, amazing. This is really bad, but also really good, because if we can get certifications to put in a living income price through consumer pressure, cha-ching, then we'd be having a completely different conversation. And I wonder, what do you think it would look like if from 1 year to the next, all the certifications started paying a living income price because of consumer pressure? I have no idea what it would do to, quote, mainstream coffee, like uncertified. But don't you think that would unlock some good stuff, you know?
Yeah, I could see it.
I could see it.
Yeah.
Because if you're certified and you're having a great time and you've got a living income, and I'm your neighbor, I'd be like, oh my God, get me on that train. Daniel, how did you do that? Where do I sign up? You know? And then, you know, some regions, the governor would help everyone get certified, and then other regions would get really jealous and be like, what? Why? Why not us? I have a feeling if consumers knew that certifications are not providing a living income, they would freak the F out. People would be very upset. That's not what they expect when they go to the store and get little certified coffee.
Yeah.
And so we can change those certifications, I think, if consumers just wake up and smell the truth. And then boom, half coffee.
Yeah, they could. But I also go back to thinking about, Sierra Leone with their diamond mining and that. I mean, people know that. I mean, I feel like you gotta to make a change. I mean, it's like you gotta be putting videos out every single day of that type of stuff for people to really to push that change. And then obviously, you obviously have to get, which is sad. It sounds like, you know, we're a business trying to market a product here. Where I say like, you know, you have to like almost get a very important, famous, influential person to then be like, oh yeah, guys, I'm changing my habits, so you should change yours. You know, call the number on your screen type stuff. You know, it's almost like I feel like you almost have to go that route rather than, you know, your average person just going, yeah, okay, that's going on. I should change my ways and now choose this one to go. Because these companies also have such a hand in marketing and I'd say lobbying in Washington, D.C. and with laws too. Because, I mean, the first company that pops in mind when I think of coffee is Starbucks. And because Dunkin' and McDonald's do a lot of coffee too, but that's not, I think of donuts with Dunkin' and then coffee, and then McDonald's, I think of coffee like fifth or 10th before I think of coffee, when I think of Big Macs and McChickens and fries. But Starbucks is, they're literally coffee. I didn't even really know that they had other things. I thought it was just coffee up until just a couple of years ago that they actually sell like muffins and stuff. But, you know, and they have such a, since they have such a market share in that, where Starbucks, I think that they claim, Starbucks in 2022, Starbucks said that 98.2% of its coffee is ethically sourced and verified through the cafe practices, which covers its 400,000 farmers in 30 countries. And I think of Starbucks and I go like, okay, if I'm Starbucks and I go, okay, you don't like what we're doing, we're going to go and use different farmers, or we're going to go and get our coffee elsewhere. And as a business, you see that humongous customer. And I feel like you'll want to do anything you can do to keep them happy. And because the biggest swayers of policy, I feel like a lot of times are these huge whales that Starbucks is in the coffee industry. Granted, I know that they've tried to in the past try to level up their ethicalness of farming, of using ethical farmers. I think of Ricardo Trios, who actually is a Miami guy. He has cacao. He gets cacao from South America for his chocolate. And he said that he knows the farmers down in South America where he gets his cacao from. And he even knows the names of their families and down to the names of their dog. That's how close he is with the farmers. And he just opened my mind about this, because Starbucks is your blanket corporate giant who gives a shit about the farmer's family and all of that too. I mean, they have shareholders to adhere to, which is their number one priority. And I don't know if you've kind of looked into what Starbucks can do and what they're doing and what they're saying they're doing, and also is what they're saying they do, are they actually doing, and is it having the effect that it was intended, which I think is the most important thing, you know?
So you were spot on with like the biggest coffee companies. You named a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Starbucks is up there. McDonald's, of course, one of the biggest purveyors of coffee in the world. You named Dunkin'. That's also exactly right. Nestle is huge. Over in Europe, you have a lot of coffee with Lavazza and Illy. But you named a lot of the big ones. So something Coffee Watch is doing now, we filed a 307 petition with U.S. Customs. A 307 petition is around forced labor. So let's say you're CBP, you're U.S. Customs. I come to you. I have a dossier. I give it to you. I'm like, hey, Daniel, I have really credible information about these horrible cases of forced labor. I've taken all the testimonies. I have many victims. It's a widespread pattern and practice.
Oh, was that the one in April of 2025 this year?
Yeah, yeah.
Let me read that. That I want to read you guys this headline. Yeah. That you guys filed the petition in under that lawsuit. Yeah. The headlines that the lawsuit and U.S. Customs and Border Patrol complaints allege slavery and human trafficking in Starbucks Brazilian coffee supply. Filed this year in April, Starbucks was dealt a double blow today as international rights advocates filed a U.S. lawsuit against the coffee titan alleging trafficking, and Coffee Watch, aka you guys, filed a petition with U.S. Customs authorities asking the government to block imports from Brazil to the U.S. of coffee tainted by slavery and forced labor by top importers, including Starbucks, Nestle, JD, Dunkin', Illy, and McDonald's. And I think that's a great idea, actually, to be able to block that, almost like it's an illegal drug coming
in. Exactly, exactly. It's exactly like that. So there's different systems, right? You know, for drugs, I would go.
I'm sure Starbucks loves you guys.
If it was drugs, I would call like DEA, obviously. But for forced labor, it's almost exact parallel, right? There is actually a law that says in America, you cannot import products that have forced labor and slavery in them. Like, you literally are not supposed to do that. It's technically illegal. Mm. The problem is, of course, crimes are hard to document. Even in the US, we don't necessarily have the money and time and resources and desire, ganas, you know, to like go out and investigate properly. So what CBP does is they don't investigate themselves. They like adjudicate when you bring it to them.
Mm.
So we knocked on their door. We brought them this 307 petition, which is almost like a lawsuit, I guess you could say, not quite. But we report to them all the people that we've documented that were enslaved or put into forced labor and human trafficking. We added in child labor, which is not really relevant, but some of the child labor is also slave labor. So the 307 petition doesn't look at child labor, but if the kids were not paid, that counts. We put all of that in with all the details, the corroborating evidence, and then we did the entire supply chain analysis to show who bought the coffee from the farm to the aggregator to the next place, all the way to the United States into the supply chains of these companies, which, as you said, is Starbucks, Nestle, JDE, Pete's, McDonald's, and Dunkin' Donuts, and Illy. And, you know, I actually think CBP takes these things very seriously. If you don't do a good job and your information is garbage, they will obviously throw it out, which is the right thing to do. But if you do your job and you present excellent information, which I think we did, then CBP literally checks everything you've done, and they will find in your favor if it was all truthful and accurate. Then what happens is they issue something called a withhold release order. That means they block the product. They have a whole dashboard of all the things that they've blocked. They've blocked palm oil. They've blocked rubber. They've blocked so many things. They've never blocked coffee before.
Mm.
But I think this may be the first time that they block a huge amount of coffee.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's looking like it.
I think we're going to get a WRO because I literally believe that everything that we wrote is truthful, accurate, and important. And more than that, I think what we showed is just the tip of the iceberg. Like, there's so much more than what we found.
And Starbucks' beans are in that.
So the beans that go from these farms that have modern slavery, forced labor, bonded labor, human trafficking.
In Brazil.
We documented how they went into Cochupé supply chain. Cochupé is like the biggest Brazilian coffee company. And then they went on from Cochupé to Starbucks, Nestle, McDonald's, et cetera. We believe. So, yeah, I mean, of course, CBP might say, Etel, your work is no good, you know, but so far we think that our work is superb and that they will find in our favor. So basically, this just gives me hope, right? Because if you look hard enough, there are so many tools, you just have to find them and try again.
And what evidence did you provide Border Patrol on giving them of the reasoning to block it? Was it like photos and videos of child labor?
So we found lots of testimonies from people. We did actually include a video.
Okay.
But we found also these government reports from the Brazilian authorities that literally corroborated everything that the victims that had been freed had told us. And then we did this really meticulous supply chain research to document every step of the chain. So yeah, it's actually quite hard. It's harder than it sounds to do this,
I've done some similar stuff with some projects, and I mean, it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
Did you ever ask Starbucks for a comment on any of this to see they say?
So we actually asked through the Business and Human Rights Research Center, which very kindly leaned in and sent our reports to all the companies that we named, for responses. And actually, we found abuses in Starbucks and Nestle's coffee supply chains in China, we think. We wrote a whole report about it called Ghost Farms and Coffee Laundering, including certified coffee. And then the companies wrote a response. We wrote a report with wonderful ally NGOs in Mexico called Opacity, and exploitation about problems in the supply chains of major coffee companies. Actually, almost all the coffee companies responded. We did, this work on
Brazil. What'd they say?
You know, in general, companies have responded to our work on China, on Mexico, on Colombia, on Brazil, on hostile lobbying that they did to try to kill good laws in Europe. And for the most part, they say, oh, like, that's not us. We didn't do it unknowingly. You know, this was part of our supply chain maybe, but it's not anymore, or we're cutting them from our supply chain, or these are bad apples. Basically, nobody has said that any of our information is wrong.
And the Starbucks have access to the evidence?
Oh, our reports are online. We have sent them. We try to do these investigations and reports and, like, I guess you could call it quasi-litigation with U.S. Customs, with CBP. Not because I, like, hate the coffee industry and want them to fail. I actually love coffee. I drink it every day. I cannot live without coffee. And I want the coffee industry to become beautiful. I want the coffee industry to be its best self. I believe that with enough pressure, all these coffee companies can change. Mm. They could pay a living income. They could have kids go to school coffee. We could have gender equality coffee instead of inequality. We could have regenerative agroforestry that's healing ecosystems. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why are we doing pesticide-soaked monoculture with deforestation? Coffee is the number six driver of deforestation in the world. That doesn't have to be that way at all. We already know there's amazing coffee in the world that's ethical, that's sustainable, that's healing broken lands, bringing back trees into agroforests, this shade-grown coffee where you mix trees with the coffee.
Yeah, yeah.
It's beautiful. It's like literally 6 or 7 times more carbon and 18 to 19 times more biodiversity. That's beautiful. Let's pop the champagne, or maybe have like a coffee
party,
a coffee margarita.
Espresso martini. I'm interested in this because I'm wondering, I mean, Starbucks obviously trying to get away from it. And probably distance itself. Oh, well, you know, they probably try to make it very general to where you can't pinpoint like the actual turning point where Starbucks takes the exact beans that you've been tracking. I'm going to see, I'm going to call Starbucks. I'm probably not going to get in a their media right now and see if I can ask them about
Amazing.
This.
That would be so cool.
Because they do have the Starbucks Global Media Relations team here. We'll see. And just ask them. See if they saw the article. See if we get lucky here. I mean, I'm sure it'll just go to voicemail or so, but I've learned more than that. Sometimes you get lucky.
Relations hotline. To continue in English, press 1.
Pour continuer en français.
If you are a member of the media, please press 1. Starbucks partners or store operators, press 2. You have been forwarded to an automated voicemail system. If you are a member of the media, please leave your name, media outlet, contact phone number, email address, deadline, and general questions after the tone. We will return your call as soon as possible. The media line is checked once each hour, Monday through Friday, between 5 a.m. and 5 p.m. Pacific time, and reviewed only periodically outside of business hours. You may also email us at press@starbucks.com. The inbox is checked Monday through Friday between 5 a.m. and 5 p.m. Pacific time. To repeat this message, press star. Otherwise, stay on the line to leave your voicemail message.
Hi, Starbucks. My name is Daniel Tintel. I'm a podcast host and YouTuber, host of the No Politics podcast. And I'm just calling to get a comment regarding the lawsuit that was filed in the U.S. by international rights advocates. And I want to get a comment as Coffee Watch, the international watchdog of the coffee industry regarding the treatment of industry workers, filed a petition with U.S. Customs authorities asking the government to block imports of your coffee beans from Brazil into the United States that were tainted by slavery and forced labor. And I just wanted to get a comment from you guys to see if, A, what your thoughts were on that petition, and B, what your thoughts were on the evidence that was produced and given to you by Coffee Watch regarding the farms in Brazil that the coffee beans allegedly were farmed from and were...
been saved and will be delivered to
Thank you. I should have been quicker than that.
Goodbye.
But they got the point, I think. You know? Yeah. I will follow back up with them too.
Amazing that you do this, Daniel, because my feeling is that actually there are kind, good-hearted people in all these big coffee companies. And one reason why the companies have been turning a blind eye, like we were also talking about producer governments and consumer governments, I guess, too, I think it's because they don't feel pressure. And as soon as pressure manifests, you can tell. Companies change. They get better. Governments change. You know, the bright spotlight of media attention makes an enormous difference. It focuses the mind. And it gives good people inside the company like almost an excuse to do the right thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, it does. It's also just a little disappointing that the, you know, that people do things because their hand is, to make change because their hand was forced to do so economically rather than them taking the free will to choose to do the right thing themselves.
That is true. I will say, though, I think that a lot of, coffee companies that kind of want to be ethical, that are like on the smaller side, they might double down on a certification because they don't really understand how good or bad or incomplete a certification is. So for example, if you have a small coffee company that's like, I want to be super sustainable, I'm going to get organic coffee only, I would say, okay, well, so bravo that you did that. But also, organic coffee doesn't look at deforestation. It doesn't look at whether your coffee was grown in a monoculture system or in an agroforest system. It doesn't guarantee a living income. By and large, it doesn't really do very much to police like child labor and bonded labor and abuse against workers, even like rape. And SGBV, women workers being exploited by supervisors.
Oh, for sure.
And so, you know, it's as if like you told me, Adele, please do the ABC with me. And I was like, A, B, C, Z. You'd say, you don't know the alphabet. That's not the alphabet. That's very incomplete. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'd be like, but I got A, B, and Z. And Z. Yeah. And he'd be like, yes, but like, where's the rest of the alphabet? I think a lot of coffee companies haven't clocked that the certifications that they've been relying on for so long are super incomplete because none of them pays a living income.
Mm.
So maybe we could say there are some companies that only do the right thing because their arm gets twisted into it, you know? But I also think maybe there are a lot of coffee companies out there, and also like hotels that serve coffee, restaurants that serve coffee, like universities or office buildings. Like there's, you know, not just coffee shops that serve coffee. It's like everyone in the world drinks coffee,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, literally.
But maybe there are hotels and restaurants and universities and offices and coffee shops that, if they knew the truth about what real good coffee looks like truly ethical, sustainable coffee, they would ask their certifications for more. They would be like, you cannot just do A, B, C, and Z. You've got to do the entire damn alphabet. Please sing it completely.
Yeah, because they only market A, B, and C that they do, you know?
But I mean, I'm the mom of a toddler. I often am so tired and discombobulated when I'm grocery shopping. I'm trying to get my toddler to not like grab all the berries and start eating them and throw things, you know, into the cart. Like, you know, random soy sauce that we don't need. My toddler loves grocery shopping, but he's very active. He never stops moving. So when I'm shopping, I often don't have the time to sit and like read every label. And people like me who are short on time, which is most normal humans, you know, you need to trust that the label is good.
Yeah, and true and accurate. And,
yeah, you cannot just like sit there having to parse, oh, is organic coffee chemical free and traceable, but it doesn't do deforestation? Like you, that's not okay. Normal people need to be able to rely that certifications are delivering what they purport to deliver, which is truly ethical, good, sustainable coffee.
Yeah. I mean, the one example of that too is I know Don Julio and Casamigos especially are dealing with their 100% agave claim on their bottles right now in lawsuits because a lot of people are saying, especially in Casamigos, that it's not 100% produced agave, which agave is what makes, you know, helps make tequila. And you have these huge brands that are stating 100% agave on the bottles. And then because Casamigos came out and it's like drinking birthday cake, everyone's like, whoa, that's not real tequila, you know? Then it throws a wrench into every other label that you've ever looked at before because you're like, wait a second, if they've been pushing this down our throat this whole time, I mean, what about everything else? Like when McDonald's finally came out and said, you know, we're finally using, you know, they marketed an all new real chicken. It was like, what the fuck? It was like, what have you been using beforehand? What is that? Been giving us? You know what I'm saying? It was like,
it's
Jesus.
Disturbing, so, right?
Yeah. Very, very disturbing. But
I think this is fixable, isn't it? Because if you just tell people the truth long enough and hard enough and they wake up and smell the coffee and the problems with the coffee, then people will demand better. And that, I think, will shift the needle. And not just people, but companies will demand better, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, you're right with that. And hopefully that's, you know, hopefully that's a shift we can make. And I appreciate you coming on, Intel. I appreciate it so much.
I'll be looking forward to that
update on the lawsuit, you know? And hopefully I'll let you know if Starbucks responds. That's really interesting because that'll be of the first of its kind. I could see that causing a big adjustment that Starbucks and these big conglomerates will have to make in the future to ensure, because that's something they've never considered to happen to them too. So keep me in touch with that. And Adele, just for people to know about Coffee Watch, where can people kind of find you guys there?
It's so simple. It's just coffeewatch.org. And then when you go to the bottom of coffeewatch.org, all of our social media is there. You can just click on whatever floats your boat. Are you on Blue Sky or Twitter or Facebook or Insta or LinkedIn or whatever? We're on all of those. You just click at the bottom of the page. You'll see all of that. And there's our newsletter.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it's all just like a one-stop shop. And we even have also one page where you can click just to find out how do you buy ethical coffee, no matter where you are. We give you guidance. We don't like recommend necessarily specific companies because it changes so much. Are you in Alaska, Florida, the UK, Canada, Mexico? It really varies from place to place, but we give as much guidance as we thought we could put into one place to help people to buy ethical coffee and like all the other good things you can do to be a ninja for sustainable coffee.
Yeah. Well, that sounds good. Thanks so much, Intel. We'll see you down the road then, okay?
Yeah, wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Of course.